This is a CBC podcast.
Birds migrating back, and then maybe we're going to get another deep freeze and it's too cold for them. But then it's also nice to be in the sunshine and to, you know, experience these blue skies.
Hey, I'm Claire Bonnieman, and this is Edmonton, a local podcast from CBC News. This year has been a wild ride in weather, and if predictions are right, it won't be stopping anytime soon. Climate change is having a real effect on Edmonton, on our industries and our economy, but also just on us. Our mental health and wellness, how we spend our free time. And with this year of weather, it's really easy to see why we might be feeling off. CBC climate reporter Stephanie Cram has been watching it all unfold and joined me to talk through what we've seen and what we might expect. So when you look back, how would you describe the last year of weather?
Yeah, if we look back to 2023, last year was dry and hot. Much like this year, Alberta didn't get much precipitation in the winter months. In fact, it was the lowest precipitation we saw in over 100 years.
Wow.
And a big reason for this is we are in, and we're still in, an El Nino weather pattern. And in particular, in the prairies, that means it's usually a warmer and drier winter. And I want to look at November in particular. So Edmonton saw no snow. It was the story of the month. According to the Weather Network, the last time Edmonton got no snow at all was, in fact, in 1928.
Whoa. So,
and the other story for 2023 in particular was the heat. A contributing factor to that is, of course, climate change. When I spoke with experts on this, they said that the extremes didn't feel as bad here in northern Alberta in particular, but there were definitely some heat waves that rolled through the prairies. One of the most notable ones was in May. It was unseasonably warm and dry, and a few days actually broke 30 degrees.
Oh, I remember those from my air conditioner-less apartment. Do you think there's one story that really maybe defined or stood out last year?
Yeah, and I think that ties in with the heat and the dryness of May of last year. And that was the catalyst for wildfires in northern Alberta, stretching into the Northwest Territories. Very early into the month, the province declared a state of emergency. And with those wildfires came a lot of smoke. So Environment Canada uses a measure of what they call smoke hours, which is hours of visibility of 9.7 kilometers or less. And Alberta broke several records with regards to smoke hours. So if you look at Edmonton saw 299 smoke hours in 2023, which was up from the previous record of 229. But the biggest jump was in Peace River. They observed 743 smoke hours, up from 192 smoke hours in 2018.
Wow.
Yeah. And Nathan Gillett, research scientist with Environment Canada, says that climate change also contributed to last year's wildfires.
Well, wildfires are, of course, an impact of climate change in terms of by drying out forests more quickly, making wildfires more likely and making them tend to spread longer and burn for a longer season. In terms of the impacts on climate change, it is true that wildfires do emit greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, which can exacerbate climate change.
Is there a precedent for that kind of weather?
Well, last year was definitely a record-breaking year. And droughts are certainly not new in Alberta. There have been a few in recent history. So if we go back not too far, in 2001 and 2002, Canada experienced an extreme drought that stretched across the entire country.
And the 2001-2002 drought is considered to be Canada's worst natural disaster to date. 41,000 jobs were lost, and it cost $6 billion in damages.
And then there was the drought in 2009. It was considered the driest in 70 years. 10 central and northern Alberta communities declared a state of emergency. So fast forward a few years into 2021, Alberta experienced another severe drought. I spoke to David Sauchin, the director of the Prairie Adaptation Research Collaborative. He said the 2021 drought was worse than the Dust Bowl, which was a nearly decade-long drought in the 1930s that many people thought was one of the worst in history.
And the key finding of all our research is if we go back 1,000 years, we find droughts that are much more severe and prolonged than anything we've been exposed to since the prairies were settled by non-Indigenous people. These droughts, these what we call pre-industrial droughts or pre-settlement droughts, they will occur in the future. But when they do, it'll be in a warmer climate. So that's what we mean by drought reoccurring today as opposed to in the past. It was quite a bit cooler. It was quite a bit cooler back then because we being people had not begun to modify the climate. So now drought is occurring in a warmer climate, so it is more impactful. Yeah, but we're also better prepared. I mean, look at the drought of the 1930s, meteorologically.
It's really hard to predict weather conditions in even a few months from now, but we can look at the data to find out a bit of information of the trends of what we might be seeing. And it's really telling us that for the second year in a row, conditions are dry. We are in a drought. We've been getting a lot of snow lately, but it might be a bit too late with the drought conditions we were already experiencing. So a few weeks ago, I spoke to John Pomeroy. He's a water scientist, and he broke down some of the data that he's seeing. If we look at the Slave Lake region, typically they get around 50 millimeters worth of water equivalent.
Water equivalent?
It's like snowfall, but it's the water equivalent of when the snow melts.
Oh,
so,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But right now they have 5, so 1/10 of normal. And one way water is measured is with a snow pillow. It's a device that measures snowpack, and there are snow pillows across the province.
Does it look like an actual pillow?
No, it's just...
I had to ask.
It almost looks like a solar panel, I guess some panels on the ground. So it measures the amount of snowpack that lands in a certain area. And there is one snow pillow near Jasper. And the numbers at the Jasper snow pillow are lower than normal as well. The area had 105 millimeters of snowpack. Normally, they would have around 170 millimeters this time of year. And just looking at the numbers more recently, it had gone up a little bit. It was sitting at 139 millimeters, but that's still significantly lower than what we should be expecting this time of year. Last year, we heard about drought, but Pomeroy told me that northern Alberta was relatively untouched because of glaciers. A lot of the glaciers were melting, so relying on glacier melt is obviously not a sustainable water solution because of that.
Are droughts now part of this new reality?
Yeah. So according to Natural Resources Canada, droughts in drier parts of the prairies will become increasingly more common and more severe. Early climate models predicted that as the atmosphere of arid and semi-arid areas, which is most of Alberta, once those areas get warmer, the area should also see more precipitation. These models were based on the premise that as the atmosphere warms, it should hold more moisture in it. But that's not happening. So a study released in January by the U.S. National Science Foundation National Center for Atmospheric Research found that arid and semi-arid lands are getting hotter, but not wetter. John Pomeroy, he said that's happening in Alberta as well.
Most of our simulations going forward show that the further north you go in Canada, the wetter the climate becomes as it warms up. So it gets even warmer as you go north and even wetter as you go north. Unfortunately, we're in a period right now where some of the months in the last year have been as warm as the worst case climate model suggests for the end of the century in Alberta, but they've been much drier than is anticipated for the end of the century.
Pomeroy said it's a bit of a wake-up call about what climate models can tell us about the future climate in this province.
Mm-hmm. I just can't imagine that this is always the most fun or uplifting reporting job. What is it like to be in the weeds of climate change day in, day out?
Yeah, well, I came to this job after working as a daily news reporter in Winnipeg, where there's lots of crime, there's lots of stories of death, so yep. There's pressures in its own way, but the death and crime definitely takes a toll on a reporter, for sure. But there have definitely been moments where I'm reading a report, where I'm talking to an expert, and I have these kind of terrified moments of realizing that the worst case scenario that these climate models have predicted are coming true. And that's a little bit terrifying, and it weighs heavy on you. But I definitely try to find the silver lining in it. So a big part of my job is to look at innovation, to see what the climate solutions are. So It definitely can take a toll on a person. And to read the headlines like I do every day, it can definitely feel like, are we going to be able to get out of this mess? Mm-hmm. And I think the most important thing is one person alone can't fix this problem.
So a lot of us feel some type of way when it comes to climate change, especially if you read the headlines or doom scroll. Sometimes it's the same thing. And I think it's important to figure out how we can manage our emotional response to massive environmental shifts, like the anxiety we feel when summer is filled with wildfire smoke, when we think about having kids in an uncertain future, or another species is labeled endangered.
It's beautiful, hey?
This is incredible.
I know. And if you, like,
luckily, there is someone at the U of A researching how we can work together to combat grief in the face of climate change. And oddly enough, her name is also Stephanie.
Hello. My name is Stephanie Olson. I use she, her pronouns. And I'm a master's student in the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. So my overall program focuses on the health impacts of climate change. And then my specific research is looking at the emotional and mental health impacts of the climate crisis and basically what helps people to cope with and metabolize experiences like ecological grief and eco-anxiety.
We met in Gold Bar Park on a slushy, sunny day, and I wanted to sit down with Stephanie because her research is rooted in public health. And while the terms climate grief or eco-anxiety aren't necessarily mainstream, it's a growing area of research.
Health is such a clear demonstration of how we are interdependent with, constituted by the environment. And what happens to the land and the environment really does happen to our bodies, and that's not a metaphor.
So what led you to this study?
So my focus on ecological grief and emotional impacts of the climate crisis, I think, was motivated by my own experience. Maybe starting like 7 years ago, I started to feel a lot more emotionally affected by the climate crisis. And I think there was a lot of reasons for that. I think that was around the time when the impact started to get a lot more in our faces with the smoky summers and the icy winters. And the science was getting a lot more terrifying as well. And then I think for me, another dimension was that I actually had a parent who had an environmental type of cancer. And yeah, that experience was like a big part of my ecological grief, both because the impacts of climate change were actually really infringing on my dad, who I love very much, on his access to the world and the things he loved. He was a big nature lover, and as we started to get these wildfire summers, it was very dangerous for his lungs to go outside sometimes, and the heat was really hard with chemo treatments, and the icy winters were hard on his wheelchair for getting outside in the winter. And yeah, I just started to really realize the stakes of the climate crisis. And, you know, I was kind of processing this loss of my dad, but also thinking about a future where, like, I couldn't cross-country ski anymore, where I wouldn't hear birds, where there'd be, you know, summers choked by wildfire smoke. And yeah, that was a lot of different kind of scales of loss that I was grappling with.
Stephanie speaks to people who are experiencing and processing eco-anxiety or grief, often through programs like Refugia, an Alberta-based organization that's been running retreats for climate-based anxiety since 2016. And she hears of the very specific ways that this feeling can manifest, especially when we see the effects of climate change in our own lives.
People feel ecological grief in pretty intimate and direct ways. I think there's almost a feeling that maybe it's going to be kind of abstract, and again, that it's primarily going to be about like other places or other species or, somewhat intellectual. But especially with how much we see these daily impacts of the climate crisis, it's really something that affects every part of people's lives. I've actually had a couple of participants talk about how falling in love like kind of brought new dimensions to their ecological grief. And I'm thinking about one person who was saying that how falling in love changed their experience of mental health and has just been a really beautiful thing. And also recognizing the things that they may not get to do with their partner, right? Like maybe they won't have kids, maybe they're not going to be able to travel, maybe these certain possibilities for the future that they would love to do are just not possible. And yeah, that was like a really interesting way that that relationship between grief and love came up.
So when people are sitting in that, when we're sitting in that, what can we do? What helps?
So something that's interesting and somewhat unique about ecological grief is it's widely considered to be a form of disenfranchised grief. So disenfranchised grief describes grief for losses that are not validated as real and impactful by the dominant culture. Like we could also think of miscarriages or a divorce or the death of a pet are all examples of really significant losses that there's not a lot of space for for acknowledging in our dominant culture. But one way to think about it is, what do we do to enfranchise that experience of ecological grief? So to really validate it and recognize it as real and impactful and meaningful. So some of the things that have come up in my research is just having community spaces where people can talk about that experience and how incredibly powerful that is for people who often feel very alone in their experience of ecological grief and other emotional impacts. And also how rare it is, even for people who like work in climate or work in environment, often that kind of emotional conversation is a bit taboo or people aren't comfortable with it. But just being able to be emotionally honest with others and to have no one try to fix it, try to minimize that pain or take it away. Yeah, again and again, people just describe how cathartic that actually is to be witnessed and to witness others and how much lighter they feel after just being able to really honestly share that.
It sounds like such a lovely idea to sit down and share with other folks. But I also know that in my own life, when I sit down with friends, we inevitably go down the climate change spiral. It really does feel like a spiral. How do you have those conversations that are more helpful than hurtful and make it so that you can come out feeling better?
This is one of the kind of distinctions about my research focusing on people who have taken like a program around ecological grief, right? So those programs do tend to have a container with them. There's like a structure to it. There's an introduction. There's a somebody like holding, you know, that space is being held in a particular way. And then people are also able to sort of leave the space and there's a way in which it's contained. So if you know that something leads to a spiral, that might not be the best way to go about it. This actually does make me think about like simple ways to bring in a little bit of ritual that can really like shift the way a space feels. For example, maybe people bring an object that actually represents the way they're feeling about climate change or something that they're worried about losing. And that's just kind of like a different emotional register for people to connect on. Doing something with those, I think a ritual is nice too, because you can kind of do something with those feelings. There can be a little bit more of a sense of maybe closure. Even having just a little bit of structure around the conversation, like here's sort of the themes that we're going to talk through. All of those things can help.
So clearly I have been doing it wrong. And if you're not quite ready yet to create a ritual or not sure how to start, Stephanie has another idea, perfect for the River Valley, that you may be doing already without even realizing.
Another common source of resilience is building relationship with the natural world. And as much as possible, making that a kind of intentional and specific process. For example, a number of people have talked about having what's called a sit spot, so a place near their home where they can frequently go and just really getting to know that place and getting to know the animals and the plants and the way the seasons are and just sort of slowing down and taking this contemplative time to really build relationship.
Do you have a sit spot right now?
I do, yeah. So mine is in Mill Creek Ravine. I live really close to there and I've had it for many years. So pretty in tune with it. Right now there's tons of coyotes. The other day there was 3 coyotes and they were like yelping all around, and yeah, it's their escorting season. But yeah, I tend to go there in the mornings and I just have a little bit, like 10 minutes of quiet time and just kind of be with my thoughts. And over time, that has been like a really meaningful and impactful practice for me.
Obviously, like the story of climate change as a whole is huge. But even just in this last week, right, we went from, I think it was like minus 30 with wind chill. I mean, we're sitting outside right now and it's like 8 or 9 degrees. When you have experiences like this one, how does that make you feel as someone who is steeped in this area of research?
Yeah, I think what I feel is often a split. Like sometimes, you know, I think a lot of people notice that when it's January and we're having like a plus 13 day, there's both the feeling like that this isn't normal. There's a lot of anticipatory fear for what it's going to mean for the world in general, for drought, for the, you know, the wildfires we're going to have this summer, for birds migrating back, and then maybe we're going to get another deep freeze and it's too cold for them. But then it's also nice to be in the sunshine and to, you know, experience these blue skies. So yeah, I'm certainly not immune to that. I think for a lot of people, and myself included, we're used to thinking about grief as bereavement, I think is like the most common way that people use that word to think about somebody having died, which is like a total loss where that person is no longer here. But oftentimes with ecological grief, what we're seeing is incremental chronic losses and this like creeping sense of unfamiliarity. Yeah, and I think the seasonal changes are like a real example of that, where it's like a cumulative effect, you know, that you're starting to notice just how different it was from when I was a kid, for example. And cross-country skiing for me is like a huge, like I love it. And it's also something I did with my dad, and that really makes me feel connected to him. And not being able to ski at all this winter was like, felt like a real loss, and also just honoring that memory and being connected. And I think that's stuff like that comes up for a lot of people.
How do you hold on to hope as we're facing, a climate crisis?
An idea that's been really helpful to me is something called active hope, which is a term coined by Joanna Macy, who's this amazing eco-philosopher and activist. And it basically recognizes that we just don't know, we can't predict the future. We don't know what's going to happen. However, what we do have control over is like living our lives in service to the things that we value, right? And so active hope is the idea of doing actions that connect me to the fact that I do love this world. I do want to see it protected. I do love so many, you know, people and places and plants and animals in it. And it doesn't have to necessarily be contingent on knowing what's going to happen, or it's like different than optimism, right? It's like action as a way of generating hope instead of only taking action if you have hope.
This Is Edmonton is a local podcast from CBC News. And our technician this week is Corey Haberstock. Our senior producer is Leslie Goldstone, and I'm Claire Bonnieman. This Is Edmonton is recorded on Treaty 6 territory, the traditional gathering place of the Cree, Soto, Blackfoot, Métis, Dene, and Nakota Sioux. You can email us a question, a comment, or an episode idea at thisisyag@cbc.ca. And leave us a rating or review wherever you find the show. Follow us or send us to somebody who you think might enjoy it. And if you have friends in Calgary, on Vancouver Island, or even all the way out in PEI, tell them to check out our whole family of hyperlocal shows. And of course, you can find us all wherever you get your podcasts.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.